United States against O'Doherty. Mr. Martin.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, Counsel. Mr. O'Doherty presents two paths in an effort to arrive at a new sentencing hearing in which the sentencing guidelines should at least be two levels lower than that found by the district court. First, this case presents an instance of the prosecution changing the stance as to tax loss that it agreed to in the plea agreement. By the time of the sentencing hearing, the prosecution backed away from what it agreed to as to tax loss when Mr. O'Doherty had pled guilty.
What wording in the tax in the plea agreement do you think they violated?
Your Honor, at page 6 of the plea agreement, which is set out in the required short appendix for the defendant at page 39, paragraph 9 starts out by stating that for purposes of calculating the sentencing guidelines, the parties agree upon the following points, except as specified below. And then there is a whole section on the guidelines, and the first section is the tax loss, which drives the offense level. And in that paragraph, which is paragraph 9B1, it states that the first words used is the parties agree that the base offense level for tax evasion is determined by tax loss, and it goes on to say that the parties, and the government's a party, acknowledges that the tax loss is more than $400,000 and less than $1 million. And it also cites the relevant conduct provision in that paragraph, and all the preceding factual basis dealt with years 2001 and 2003, did not deal with these other years that came up later on. So that's the basis in the plea agreement. I would note that in prior cases, the courts, similar language, they don't even question that this is what the government agreed to in the plea agreement, and that question becomes whether they honored that at the sentencing hearing. What did not occur in this case is the government did not state, you know what, Your Honor, the probation office conducted its own investigation. It came up with a different conclusion, but we stand by our plea agreement. We stand by what we're asking.
The language in the plea agreement on which you rely says, at least as I read it, that your client concedes that the prosecutor can establish a tax loss exceeding $400,000. Where's the representation by the prosecutor? There's a concession by the defendant, but there doesn't appear to be any statement by the prosecutor.
It states the parties acknowledge that the
parties acknowledge that the prosecutor can do X, right? But what you need is a statement, and the prosecutor agrees that it won't argue for more. And that's not there. In fact, the next paragraph says the parties reserve the right to make different arguments.
And that's reserved the right to make different arguments on the sophisticated means enhancement.
Well, you've got that paragraph 9E language that's pretty tough, though, saying you have no right to rely on these preliminary estimates or whatever you want to call them.
Your Honor, I do not deny that language is in the in the plea agreement, but that's a different issue from what the government agreed to as to the guidelines. In every plea agreement that comes before the court, the parties usually attempt to reach guideline agreements in ones that they don't agree to. There was no statement in the tax loss provision that the parties agreed to disagree. There was no statement in the tax loss guideline provision in the plea agreement that there was a dispute over relevant conduct. Relevant conduct was not even mentioned there. This language must mean something that's in the plea agreement. Perhaps it's inconsistent. If it's inconsistent, because of the nature of plea agreements, the tie goes to the defendant. But let's put that aside.
What's the tie? The exact language of 9E says, acknowledge that the calculations are preliminary in nature, quote, and are non-binding predictions upon which neither party is entitled to rely, close quote. What's ambiguous about that?
There's nothing ambiguous about that, but that has to be taken in context to what preceded it, and that was...
What preceded it is an estimate, and the next paragraph says neither side can rely on that estimate.
Well,
pretty straightforward.
I'll just say this, Your Honor. What preceded it was an agreement in paragraph 9. The parties agree on these guideline points. And the agreement was for a tax loss of $400,000 and based on the 3 years in question.
Yes, it's specifically tied to those 3 years. There's really no reference at all to preceding or succeeding years, right?
There is not. And I'll get to that in one moment, but this language was treated as an agreement on sentencing guidelines. And the point is, when a government commits to something like this, they have an obligation to say, this is what we agreed to, Your Honor, and the defendant has an obligation of specific performance of that. But put that aside. I'm getting adrift that the safe harbor language is sufficient in this case, which really means that in any case, as long as this language is included, whatever agreements are reached to the guidelines are precatory. But be that as it may, the government still has a burden of proof at sentencing. It's the government's burden to prove the amount of tax loss. And in this case, the government came forward with no evidence whatsoever.
Well, now, I'm curious about that because the civil case is based on assessments, isn't it? Assessments for the tax years of the preceding years. Right?
It was based on a civil complaint that was filed in 2007 that was pending in the district
right.
court.
Right. The civil complaint is based, in the complaint itself says that it's based on assessments sent on thus and so dates, right?
The actual complaint is not in the record. The underlying documentation is not in the record. I have, of course, looked at it, and it's a suit brought by the commissioner that says for this year, because of a 1099, X amount is owed. And that was an allegation at the point of time of sentencing. It still is. The case isn't resolved.
And in the stay of that case is at your client's request, isn't it? His same counsel that he had at the sentencing he had in the civil case, and that counsel requested the stay of the civil proceeding pending the outcome of the criminal case, right?
I have no reason to doubt that, Your Honor. I was not the lawyer.
Right. It was not you, right?
Right. But I have no reason. The case was stayed, and it's still stayed as of this date because he doesn't have an attorney.
And I can't recall the exact language of the PSR, but I think the PSR makes reference to the assessments. It certainly refers to the civil case, and I think it makes some reference to the assessments.
Yes. Well, what happened was the probation officer talked to the IRS agent who referenced the probation officer to the pending civil case, and that's what the probation officer used. Now, the pending civil case appears to be based on 1099s. And I say appears, and I said this in a brief, because the 1099s were never presented to the court. 1099s are not a tax return. They're not a statement of the taxes due. And in this case, given the nature of Mr. O'Doherty's business, what the defense said was, A, that they're a gross figure, not a net figure.
Right, and I guess what I'm getting to is, that was known to O'Doherty as early as April, and he asked for a continuance of the sentencing to go at that.
That's correct.
And then when the sentencing was finally held in June, that was still his concern, but he didn't produce anything to refute the assessments or the other allegations of the civil complaint.
Based on the there was a problem with that because REFCO, the clearinghouse, had been put in receivership. He had spent his efforts working with the government, his accountant and the government agents. They got what a figure for the actual charge years was actually $700,000. They got that down under $400,000 based on records. And the district court even said, you got to look at the district court's findings. The government couldn't explain why it popped up in 1 year. And the judge even said that, you know, I find this number to be speculative. If we could go through it all, it would probably be lower.
And he even gave a downward variance, if you would, in part on that reason.
That's correct. But there's an obligation upon the district court to correctly compute the guidelines. And he went downward. He did. There were other factors for the variance in this case besides right. the overstatement of taxes. He didn't assign a numerical number. Well, I'm giving 6 months off because his daughter has cancer. I'm giving 6 months off because he cooperated in a prosecution. So based on this record, we can't say that if the court had found there was a failure of proof and started with a lower number, that the sentence would have been the same. And that's why the error is prejudicial in this case. I reserve my few moments for rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Podlyska.
Thank you, Your Honors. Your Honors, may it please the court. As a preliminary matter, let me just address one thing with respect to the sophisticated means, even though counsel didn't argue that particular point. In our brief, Your Honors, we did quote the definition of sophisticated means, but we quoted the definition, an earlier definition, and we wanted to make clear that we're not in disagreement with the defense, that, of course, it's the definition in the 2009 guidelines book that controls here, and that was the definition that was used in the district court as well. So I just wanted to make that clear to the court. Now, with respect to what's been raised by the defense, that subparagraph 9E resolves, Your Honors, the issue about the breach, any possible breach of the plea agreement. It states very clearly that these are non-binding predictions on which neither party can rely, and that really ends the issue. There are other subparagraphs as well that limit the impact of the calculations of the guidelines. Now, with respect to the tax loss matter, as the court noted, there the PSR at lines 49 through 57 discusses the tax losses from the earlier time period. The only discussion there is as to the tax due. So we don't, there isn't a discussion. It doesn't set forth what the initial gross income was. We have the tax due amounts based upon the complaint that had been filed in the civil case. But there was no dispute in the district court, and indeed, we don't read the briefs here to be a challenge to the gross receipts, the 1099s. That was not what the defendant was disputing. His concern and his objection was that he wasn't getting credit for legitimate deductions. And that's his continued argument here, that the government didn't carry its burden of showing tax loss because we didn't show what the deductions were that he was entitled to, and we didn't deduct from that gross income the deductions to which he would have been entitled. But he's not entitled to legitimate deductions at this point. There's a time and a place for claiming what he would say would be legitimate deductions from gross income. That's when he's under an obligation to file a tax return in the first place. He didn't file tax returns for any of those years, so he never claimed the deductions. And this court addressed that issue in United States versus Chavin. When we come up for sentencing in a criminal case and we're determining tax loss, it's not the time and place to sit down to try and recreate, or in this case, create for the first time a perfect tax return for the defendant that would itemize in detail whatever deductions he could have taken if he had filed the tax returns when he should have. This court in Chavin said that we take the tax return as the defendant chose to file it, which in this case is no tax return at all. And therefore, there is no adjustment to be made for the amount of deductions. It is a tax based upon the 1099s. With respect to the harmless error aspect, it is not correct that we don't know from this record whether if the guidelines were calculated differently, the judge's sentence would have been different. Even if there is any error here, it's what Judge Leinenweber said about the sentence that he was imposing, and I would direct the court's attention to page 13 of the plea agreement proceedings, where he was explaining to Mr. O'Doherty what it meant that the guidelines were now advisory. And he told Mr. O'Doherty that what that meant was, even if the court accepted the government's calculations of the guidelines as correct, that the court might still sentence Mr. O'Doherty according to Mr. O'Doherty's calculations of the guidelines, that he had the authority to do that.
I don't understand the significance of this. We've said quite a lot of times that district judges are free to say at sentencing that even if I had resolved this dispute the other way, the sentence would be the same, so it doesn't matter. In fact, we keep urging district judges to say that. But you're not arguing that the judge here said that, are you?
He did not say that.
Right. The statement at the time of accepting a plea that the judge might do something like that doesn't tell us that he did it. Now, I'm a little puzzled by why district judges almost never do that, and it appears that prosecutors almost never say to district judges, please make that finding. It will avoid the need for an appeal.
And we did not say that here. The judge, though, did articulate his reasons both orally at the sentencing and in writing, where he analyzed the basis for why he was imposing the sentence that he did. And he started with the fact that the income calculations concerned him that they might be too speculative. And he stated that for that reason, in his view, at the end of the day when all the records would come in, the tax loss probably was going to be less than $1 million. And therefore, he was not going to impose the sentence under the guidelines for in excess of $1 million. And the sentence that he did impose, the defense argues it was at the high end of the applicable range. That's only if the defense is correct about both the tax loss argument and the sophisticated means argument. Otherwise, it was at the low end of what would have been the applicable guideline range that the defense itself was proposing.
We would not have had this appeal, therefore, had the district court said it just doesn't matter which range I chose.
That's certainly correct.
When the sentencing guidelines were first issued, both the Sentencing Commission and in a separate article, Judge Breyer, as he then was, the principal architect of the guidelines, urged district judges to say that. Judges have been urging district judges to say that now for 24 years, and it hasn't happened. So we're not going to pretend it happened here.
Well, it's certainly the case that it was not, those words were not said here. That is absolutely correct. Unless there are further questions, we don't have anything further. Thank you.
Thank you very much. The case is taken under advisement, and the court will be in recess until tomorrow.